Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group and the Constitution Project, was recorded on Tuesday, November 24, 2015, during a live teleforum conference call.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group teleforum conference call, Pros and Cons, Our Criminal Justice System at Work. My name is Katie McClendon. I'm the Director of Publications at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our experts, Professor William Otis of Georgetown University Law Center and Judge Alex Kaczynski of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Professor Otis will give some opening remarks, followed by remarks from Judge Kaczynski, and then we'll open the floor for your questions. Thank you so much for being here. Go ahead, Professor Otis.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you very much, Katie. I had the opportunity to see a tape of Judge Kaczynski's discussion of this topic with Judge Wilkinson from my old stomping grounds, the Fourth Circuit, and I appreciate Judge Kaczynski's willingness to consider the question again in today's call. Judge Kaczynski started his criticism of our criminal justice system by noting, in a frequently heard phrase, that the United States has become incarceration nation. We have 5% of the world's population, but 25% of its prisoners. For several reasons, I think this is a misguided argument. First off, it's a mistake to accept other nations' statements of their prison population. Iran, Russia, China, to take three big ones, might be telling the truth, but you wouldn't want to bet the rent on that. Second, even if the statements are true, it's hard to know what, if anything, international comparisons tell us. Different countries have different demographics, culture, history, and legal traditions. Many use corporal punishment as an alternative to prison, including the Islamic world, which has a collective population five times that of the United States. We all hear about the need to respect other countries and other value systems. These harsh, though widely used, alternatives to prison, though, never seem to come up in the discussion of the supposed moral shortcomings of the incarceration-happy United States. The third and by far the most important reason it's a mistake to concentrate on the incarceration rate is that that is a misdirected focus. The correct measure of the system's health is not the incarceration rate, it's the crime rate. Viewed by that measure, which oddly, or perhaps not so oddly, tends to get de-emphasized in debates like this one, our criminal justice system is an astonishing success. It has helped reduce crime by half in the last 25 years, the biggest drop over the shortest time in American history. According to the Uniform Crime Reports, there are 5.4 million fewer serious crimes and 10,000 fewer murders per year now than there were a generation ago. I cannot begin to estimate the fortune we have saved and the amount of human misery and suffering we've averted because of this achievement. It's true that not all the crime decrease is because of the criminal justice system, but it simply can't be denied that a major part of it is due to the very innovations in that system that now serve as legal academia's bad boy. More prosecutions, more incarceration for longer terms, more police, and more proactive and aggressive policing. If we now turn away from these things to re-embrace, as Ronald Reagan once said, the failed policies of the past, we'll get the failed results of the past. As conservatives in particular ought to know, the past is worth remembering. As I've debated this subject in other forums, I have been struck with the degree of forgetfulness and, to be honest, complacency, I see. As the 1960s dawned, two things dawned with it: a snarling antagonism toward police and prosecutors, like the one we see being repeated now, and a not unrelated 25-year-long crime wave. Between 1960 and the early years of the Reagan administration, crime increased 400%. Whole neighborhoods in our inner cities became free fire zones, largely because of the gunplay associated with drug dealing. It took the better part of 30 years to turn this around, but eventually we did. As Heather McDonald reminded us in a recent column, 10,000 black men in New York City alone are alive today who would have been dead if the murder rate there had continued to be what it was in 1991. From the idea that our criminal justice system is dysfunctional, I respectfully dissent. Now, Judge Kosinski has pointed to dozens of examples of slipshod, dishonest, and/or deceitful work by prosecutors to maintain, as I do, that the criminal justice system fairly judged is a success is scarcely to say that it could not use significant improvement. But at least two things need to be borne in mind as we set about that task. First, one can take the worst one-half of 1% of the behavior of any profession, prosecutors, doctors, butchers, bakers, or candlestick makers, and make that profession out to be a cesspool. As Judge Kosinski has elsewhere pointed out, Mike Nifong, the Duke Rape Hoax prosecutor, may lead the prosecutorial pack in the cesspool category, although he was probably outdone by the DA who put Michael Morton in jail for 25 years by hiding a mountain of Brady material. But by similarly skewed selectivity, the, quote, X profession reeks of corruption narrative could also be woven about at least two other actors in the criminal justice system, defense lawyers, and, if dare I say it, judges. I could talk about the defense lawyer in New Jersey, Paul Berggren, who was convicted of conspiring to murder a government witness. This is not his client. This was the lawyer. As an article in the New Yorker put it, quote, "No witness, no case. That was Paul's motto," said one attorney who knew him. When your customers are all criminals, what's better advertising than a prison tattoo? And while Berggren is an extreme example, a fancy dance, shall we say, with the truth, is not exactly unheard of in criminal defense work. Or I could talk about judges whose behavior was not merely sloppy or unethical, but criminal. Walter Nixon, Otto Kerner, Harry Claiborne, who continued to preside over cases from his prison cell, and Alcee Hastings, whose accountability, as it were, for selling favorable treatment to a defendant was to become one of the most senior members of the leadership in the House of Representatives. I could talk about the judges exposed in Chicago's Operation Greylord, in which one member of the bench competed with the next to take bids for dismissing cases. Or I could talk about the Montana judge recently who gave a school principal a one-month sentence for raping a 14-year-old on the grounds that she looked older than that. It would not serve a sensible discussion, however, to do more than mention these very rare instances in passing. They balance, to an extent, the portrayal of prosecutors as the gremlin on the wing, but florid antidotes do little to point us toward realistic and doable reform. A person of conscience cannot help but agree with Judge Kosinski's outrage at the wrongful conviction of the innocent. With respect, however, what I believe is missing here is the understanding that a wrongful failure to punish the guilty is also a miscarriage of justice and poses a danger to the public when the supposedly exonerated criminal, emboldened at having once snookered the system, victimizes an innocent yet again. This is a serious harm in itself, yet goes mostly unmentioned in debates like this. Judge Kosinski and others with his viewpoint get it, that careless and dishonest prosecutions undermine public trust as well as work gross individual injustices. What we need also to get is that the public's distrust and a good deal of injury to boot will result if prosecutors are deprived of useful and constitutionally sound tools. The system has limited resources and is about balance. Adding burdens to the everyday tasks of prosecutors will decrease the protection they are able to produce by incapacitating criminals. If, for example, we were to require prosecutors to obtain unanimous verdicts from juries of 24 rather than 12, it would doubtless reduce the already small number of wrongful convictions. The problem is that it would also reduce the large number of correct ones. For every benefit we get, there is a cost we will pay, and those least able to pay it will wind up with the biggest share of the bill. It's with this unhappy but inescapable fact that I turn to some proposals for reform. George Kosinski, in his recent but already famous introduction to the annual Georgetown Review of Criminal Procedure, made many such proposals. With the limited amount of time I have left, I want to disagree with one of them and note two where we might find common ground. I disagree with Judge Kosinski's proposal to overrule the Supreme Court's decision in Imbler v. Pacman, upholding the doctrine of prosecutorial immunity. It's surely tempting to want to hold a crooked and abusive prosecutor to account by forcing him to answer a civil suit, but there's a reason the judgment in Imbler was unanimous, penned by Justice Powell for the court and concurred in by Justice White, together with Justices Brennan and Marshall. The concurrence led off by agreeing that, and I'm quoting here with the ellipses, a prosecutor is absolutely immune from suit for money damages for presentation of testimony later determined to have been false, where the prosecutor did not believe it or should not have believed that it was true. Here's the problem the court faced, which I summarized less eloquently than it did. If prosecutors are required to answer civil complaints about their official behavior, they will be doing nothing else. The primary plaintiffs will not be the handful of those wrongfully convicted. They will be the legions of the rightly convicted, sitting around their cells, building self-justification and resentment, with time on their hands and nothing to lose by trying. Such suits will not only make impossible the change of attitude needed for genuine rehabilitation, they will put a perverse cap on future prosecutions. Perfectly honest prosecutors everywhere will spend the great bulk of their time and your money answering fabricated complaints rather than going after the fellow who ransacked your house last night. Now, there's one probably major reform Judge Kosinski and I agree on. The Federal Criminal Code is overstuffed, running on for hundreds of pages describing offenses consisting of behavior no normal person would suspect is wrong, much less criminal. Criminalizing the regulatory state by jettisoning the mens rea requirement undermines the moral basis and hence the public authority of criminal law itself. If we must have an overwrought regulatory state, it should be enforced by someone who is not menacing, like the local SWAT team, but merely annoying. Last, Judge Kosinski and I might agree that we should limit the number of cases resolved by plea agreements. Plea bargains are an economic necessity, given the limited resources taxpayers are willing to invest in the system, but the frequency with which we do them now has become an addiction. When 97% of your cases are resolved through bargaining, it spawns a host of bad incentives. Prosecutors are tempted to settle a case on the cheap simply to get to the next one. Defendants may be tempted to eat a credible defense just to end at the expense and turmoil. Conversely, of course, they might be overjoyed to be able to walk away from behavior the prosecutor might have found out about with a less pressing caseload. Judges are spared the rigorous and time-consuming work of trial, but over time may lose discipline in ways that disserve justice. All in all, our long over-reliance on plea bargaining has become the petri dish of poor behavior from prosecutors, defense counsel, and judges alike. And I'll just close by saying we need to do much more serious thinking than we have up to now about how to rein it in.
My turn?
I think it is.
It's a pleasure to be here. I've never done a teleforum before, but I'm looking forward to getting questions from the audience. Let me be fairly brief in responding to Professor Otis's a very well thought out opening statement, which I thought was quite moderate and quite sensible, and with which I agree with in many ways, particularly the part where he agrees with me. I particularly don't want to agree with the basic point that he makes is that I do not favor a complete overhaul of the criminal justice system in the sense that we throw out everything and start from scratch. What I did in my article in the Georgetown Law Journal is to flag what I saw were some troubling trends. And I said up front, not any of these, or maybe not all of them, or not every one of them, may turn out to be problematic on closer inspection, but there was enough cause for concern based on my 30 years of being a court of appeals judge and seeing cases, both federal cases and state habeas, as to give me the willies. It just gives me a sense of discomfort that many of the assumptions we made about the way our criminal justice system works is, most of those things are based, I think, on faith, on guesswork, and on inertia. We've done things the same way for a very long time, and therefore we tend to have a sense that having done it this way, it must be right. Let me say a couple of quick words about the statistics on prisons. And I started there in my discussion at Cato. I and Professor Otis addressed them. I don't think they can be dismissed quite as easily as Professor Otis suggests. I mean, he talked about places like Russia and China and the like. But let's just focus in on countries that are really very much like our countries, like Canada. I mean, Canada is about as close to the United States demographically as you're going to find, where we share a long border together, we mostly share a language, we share much of a culture, and, you know, we're on the same continent. And yet our incarceration rate, we have something like 700 per 100,000 people incarceration rate. 700, that's a number to keep in mind. The number in Canada is 118 per 100,000. Canada, a country of 35 million people, has fewer prisoners by long shot than Louisiana with 5 or 6 million people. It is an astonishing difference. Now, I can't believe that our crime rate, our demographics, our way of life is so much more dangerous than that of Canada. There's something else going on. The corresponding number for a place like Germany is 79, for England it's 130. We have 700. These are people for 100,000. So I think it is something that's just worth thinking about. There's so many countries that look like us have so much fewer, such a smaller percentage than we do people in prison. This is something we ought to be concerned about. We ought to study and figure out why it is that their numbers are so much lower than ours. And maybe they are doing something differently, and our numbers may be too high. Now, Professor Otis has pointed out that there has been a significant drop in crime rates in the last 20 years. But that is true, and he attributes it. I think he uses the implicitly, he talks about as if the incarceration rate and the crime rate drop are linked, that one has caused the other. But the fact of the matter is crime has dropped at about the same rate in all other first world countries. Crime has dropped just about the same in almost all categories in other first world countries. So and they have not had the incarceration rate that we have. So something else is going on. Most experts who have thought about it believe that it has a lot to do with the aging of the population and the shrinking population. And if you looked at the Wall Street Journal front page, it was either yesterday or the day before, there was an article about the problem of shrinking and aging populations, particularly in first world countries. One of the industries has been affected by all industries are affected by it, and one of the industries apparently affected by it is crime. So I am not sure that we can say putting people in prison is the cause for our drop in crime rates. Now, I am in full agreement with much of what Professor Oger said about prosecutors. I think most prosecutors, just like most judges and most lawyers, are ethical. I think that they do a good job, and they try to cut corners squarely. But we've had too many instances recently, what I think are too many instances of real serious defamation of breaches of duty by high-ranking officials. Not just in the States, but also in the Justice Department. Professor Otis mentioned Nye Fong, the North Carolina case, and the case from Texas. But, you know, what about cases like the prosecutions of Senator Stevens, which was handled right out of Maine Justice, right in the middle of Washington, D.C.? And then we have these tactics being used by prosecutors that are just unheard of before. This is the case out of the Fifth Circuit, where Judge Jones wrote a very angry opinion about the blogging prosecutors. So these were prosecutors who a day would be in court prosecuting the defendants. At night, they would be posting blogs, defiling those defendants anonymously. And that was done by prosecutors both located in Louisiana, in New Orleans, but also one of them a justice, and she is still there at the Civil Division in Justice. Because time is short, I want to focus on the emerging doubts about forensic science. Much of what goes on in our criminal courtrooms, much of the science that's presented, does not get subjected to Daubert analysis, fingerprints, hair analysis, bite marks, rifling, and so on. They get admitted, people come and testify as experts, and they get accepted as experts, and people get convicted. And yet we've had massive indications that that some of those and many of those programs, many of those things that purport to be science are in fact not science at all, or at least if they are science, are subject to serious error rates. And I don't have time to go through all of them, although there is science showing that everything is subject to error rate, including handwriting identification, bite marks, hair identification seems to be almost useless, fingerprint identification. But let me focus on the Inspector General's report that deals with the problem of forensic examiners over the last 20 years. In 1994, a whistleblower from the FBI disclosed that the FBI was doing a shoddy work in providing forensic analysis. The Justice Department set up a task force, and the task force was supposed to go over and determine whether or not these reports were justified. And what they found is basically hundreds and hundreds of cases, and where the FBI experts testified, essentially they testified falsely or based on no evidence at all. Now, it has taken 20 years, and the Inspector General did another report talking about what has happened in the meantime. We're now 20 years or 18 years after this task force started. People have been in prison, and it turns out that there were 7,600 cases identified by 13 examiners whose methods were in doubt. 2,800 of those resulted in conviction. Of those, only 338 of those have been reviewed. Including these are cases where people have been sent to death row, some have been executed, some have died of natural causes in prison. And here it is almost two decades later, and there has been no effort. There's one particular examiner by the name of Malone, who apparently, a hair examiner, who apparently all of his testimony was bogus. There was nothing he said. In no case, apparently, did he provide anything like scientific evidence. The IG fought the FBI for not even going through and pulling all of his cases and at least determining whether people who have been convicted by him are now in prison based entirely on the bogus testimony of this guy Malone. And as it happens, there is a case pending in our court raising precisely this issue involving somebody who's been in prison 20 years or more based on solely on Malone's testimony. I can't say anything more about it, but in fact, these are real people. So I think we have been a little slow in recognizing faults with our system. And I think one thing we need to do, and I hope Professor Otis agrees with me on this, is that when we do find flaws in the system, as happened with the FBI examiners, that we will show more alacrity in making corrective measures. Surely there's no excuse for us to keep people in prison when we develop serious independent doubts that the reason they've been put there is is a lie or is not supported by evidence.
Thank you both for your comments. To our audience, I'll now open the floor to your questions. In a moment, you will hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then pound. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, press star and then pound. Let's go to our first question.
Hi, this is Stevie Snyde. I teach at the University of Wyoming College of Law. Bill, you may remember me from days long ago.
Hey, hi, how you doing?
Great, and this has been very informative. I thank both you and Judge Kaczynski. It occurs to me that the best mechanism we have created for catching the sorts of errors and misbehavior that Judge Kaczynski articulately pointed out is the trial. And I think the biggest, my own personal view is that we are in a post-trial world, largely, in the criminal justice system. Both of you have noted that. I know the courts are under a lot of pressure to resolve cases efficiently, and trials are not an efficient mechanism. What can we do as a practical matter to bring the trial back so that there really is a Sixth Amendment right to trial, as opposed to what we have now, which is many prosecutors, it is my sense, demanding a very high price for going to trial. It seems like the unofficial rate for going to trial for many years was in the 20 to 25% range on sentences, and now prosecutors are threatening significantly greater charges for going to trial. What can we do about it systemically with all the power that prosecutors naturally have?
Well, may I suggest one thing, and that is that the obligation to provide Brady material ought to be applied before any plea bargain. Basically say any evidence that the prosecutor does not provide before the plea bargain starts cannot be used at trial. You know, unless, of course, it's found, you know, if anything later discovered would, of course, be excluded. But anything the prosecutor has that he does not lay on the table before negotiations would be not be used at trial. And that way defendants can make a more reasoned assessment as to whether or not what they are facing is justifiable. I would suggest open file discovery as the way they have in North Carolina. But there may be too much to hope for.
Let me just chime in on that. When I was in the U.S. Attorney's Office, although under existing law, what's required is the disclosure of exculpatory material, I agree that prosecutors should turn over, and that there should be an open file policy. And the reason I agree with that is my underlying view of the criminal justice system. It's not a game. Particularly prosecutors should think this way. In my view, which is a minority view, the legal profession should orient itself and its ethical standards more toward the ascertainment of truth and less toward being all in for the client come hell or high water. As I say, that's a minority view, but for purposes of answering this particular question, I completely agree with Judge Kosinski. Open file policy, not required by the judiciary, but as a matter of executive branch policy, should be instituted. It's the one that I followed. And the other part of the answer is one of the things I was talking about in my opening remarks. We've become addicted to plea bargains. I understand the economics of it, but the fact of the matter is that plea bargaining, to the extent it's done now, incentivizes sloppy and sometimes dishonest behavior, and we should cut back on it. Again, the place that I think bears the onus to do the cutting back is the prosecution. I think, and if I were to go back into the government, I would suggest to my superiors in the Justice Department that U.S. attorneys' offices be strongly encouraged to cut back on the percentage of cases they resolve with plea bargains and do a significantly more by trials. Trials, after all, that are the only constitutionally designated way for the resolution of felony charges. I think it would be more in keeping with what the framers had in mind for our system, and it would certainly cut back on these adverse incentives that are infecting the system top to bottom right now. I should probably say one more word, which is that the proposal that I would make would for increasing the percentage of trials or instead of plea agreements would run into resistance, not just from the department, and it would run into white-hot resistance from the defense bar, and I suspect a good deal of resistance from district judges, because the on-the-ground reality is that the defense bar lives off plea bargains because, as is the case in civil litigation, cases are cheaper to settle than to try, and let's just face it, the remuneration for defense lawyers, for privately retained defense lawyers, is going to go up the more cases they can settle rather than put in all the time and effort to try. So any proposal by the U.S. Attorney's Office to cut back on plea bargaining, I think, is going to encounter a good deal of resistance from the defense. I hope that won't work out that way, but that's what I expect to happen.
Let's go to our next caller.
This is David Applegate in Chicago. I'm as concerned about the over-prosecutorial reach as anyone in this country, but I was struck by Judge Kosinski's comments comparing the demographics of Canada with those of the U.S., and particularly by the comparison of Canada and Louisiana. I live in Chicago, as I said. I've visited 48 of the 50 states, lived in 7 of them, and visited 3 or 4 Canadian provinces. And it's my impression that the racial and ethnic demographics of the United States and Canada are not at all similar. I recognize that race and ethnicity are delicate topics in today in particular, but does Judge Kosinski, on reflection, really think that the comparison of Canada and the United States is all that apt?
Yes, I do. I mean, your personal passion for having traveled to some provinces of Canada, just look at the statistics. They really are not that different from us. And I'm not sure that to what extent demographics you think play a role, but they have a significant number of minorities. So certainly we are not that different from
Hi, so I wanted to ask and thank you both for your time.
You think the difference might be, you know, 7 times the number of people in prison. Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry for interrupting. I got a message on the teleconference, I guess. So I had wanted to ask, and again, thank you both for your time, what would you guys say to young prosecutors who are now emerging sort of into joining the profession in a time where society is now liberalizing and, you know, young prosecutors now probably haven't seen and for the most part have not probably participated in a lot of the abuses that are now coming to light, but at the same time might feel as though they're being lumped in with some of the wrongdoers, especially given a lot of the rhetoric. And yet, for the most part, you know, these people are folks who want to do the job, who probably grew up believing that it was a socially valuable profession and even arguably an obligation. And I wonder what you would think. I mean, do you think an obligation, whether we're in the news media, whether we're pundits or whether we're professionals, to moderate our rhetoric, to sort of protect the profession so that we make sure that we're drawing highly educated and skilled young professionals to join it, rather than scaring folks off and saying, well, you know, by doing this, by choosing to sort of be the bad guy, as it were, and be the prosecutor, that you're asking for a career of trouble and sort of opening yourself up to a attack or ridicule.
I, for one, am overjoyed that someone who thinks as you do is entering the field as a prosecutor, as you correctly intuit. And it is my experience that prosecutors come into the profession not because they're punitive, not because they like wielding power, although, of course, there are some people like that. For by far the most part, they entered the profession for a mirror image reason that people become public defenders, which is that they think it advances the public good and that they are protecting people who can't afford, you know, fancy houses in the suburbs and can't afford a private alarm system. And the best protection they have in order to lead a peaceable and productive life is the protection that police and prosecutors will afford them. So good for you. You're thinking the right thing. And I, as Judge Kosinski has said, even those who tend to be skeptical of prosecutors and some of the things that have come to light, almost all of them believe that on the whole, prosecutors are, you know, honest people and are serving the public well. Having said that, there are, you know, it's a combat profession, and some of the opposition to prosecutors is always going to be there, and some of it is always going to be overhyped because prosecutors have an opponent. That opponent is called defense lawyers. And defense lawyers have been known to participate in some of what I view as the overly heated criticism of prosecutors precisely to gain an advantage in the PR battle. But that's always going to be the case, law and criminal law in particular. Is, as I say, a combat profession. The thing to do is just accept that and do what your conscience and the U.S. Attorney's Manual tells you to do.
You know, I would agree with all or most of that, particularly, you know, as it seems to be directed at federal prosecutors, and I think I do think that among federal prosecutors, the problem prosecutors are much fewer. I would be a little more cautious about state prosecutorial offices, and some of those again, there are very many very fine prosecutors, but there are some offices where unwholesome practices have been going on for quite some time. Now, I don't want to say too much about it, but there's a big case going on right now in Orange County, for example, where a judge has disqualified the entire Orange County DA's office because of what he discovered to be an ongoing, decades-long program of having them cooperating with the sheriff, where they put witnesses in, known snitches in, with various defendants for whom they didn't otherwise have evidence, And lo and behold, the snitches would come out and say, oh, yes, the guy confessed to me. And this happened on a repeated basis. I just had people I could rely on to come and make those claims. And I the case is pending. I don't want to say too much more about it, but I've seen other instances where specific prosecutorial officers at the state level have been led wrong or have had a culture of misconduct. Mr. Nifong in North Carolina is perhaps is another example. So I would be careful in joining the ranks of prosecutors to check out the reputation of the particular prosecutorial office. I think most are fine, most are want to do the right thing in the right way. But there are these pockets of corruption or misconduct that I think if one gets into there, one is at risk of being sucked down that particular hole.
We have a couple more callers waiting, but I just wanted to announce that our next scheduled Teleforum conference call will be on Monday, November 30th at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll host a conversation about developing an international response to the Paris attacks. Please consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleforum conference calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org, and visit our website to listen to podcasts of previously recorded Teleforums you might have missed. All right, now to our next caller.
Hello, Judge Kaczynski and Bill Otis. This is Rory Little from San Francisco.
Rory.
I'm very happy that you guys are doing this. And Bill, it's been a long time, but it's nice to hear you.
Yeah, hi. How you doing, Rory?
I have a very small point to make, but it's one that sort of continually bothers me from both sides, which is the use of the phrase prosecutorial misconduct to describe Brady violations that turn out not to be the fault of the prosecutor, but of other actors in the system, either agents or forensic examiners or other people. I'm very glad that this attention is being paid to all these issues, but I wish the phrase would be used with a little more discrimination so that prosecutors who are blameless in some sense are not tarred with the brush of misconduct because it has very bad personal consequences for them. And many Brady violations are because the prosecutor had no idea that the information existed because somebody else in the system was withholding it. Even in the face of sometimes responses or requests from the prosecutor. And meanwhile, prosecutorial misconduct loses a bit of its sting when it's used too indiscriminately. So that's my only comment, and I'd love to hear either of you respond.
Well,
thank you.
You know, I agree with that, and I think it's important when we speak out on the questions that we identify who caused the problem. But it's not as simple as Rory, as you suggest. Take, for example, the Olson case, the one where I used the phrase, and I guess has been widely quoted, that there is a epidemic of Brady violation. What happened in that case is the prosecutor got calls from the investigators. There was an investigation going on, a report, and he called in and asked for the information, and the people who were doing the report got back to him, but he just didn't bother returning the calls. Now, in a sense, you might say, well, you know, he didn't actually have the information, and he didn't, you know, so he really can't be personally guilty of withholding information because he didn't have it. But, you know, I'm pretty sure that if this had been a witness, somebody calling and saying, I have information that will help your case, that prosecutor would have found time to get back and get the information. Calling back to get information that will undercut your case just didn't seem to be very important on his part. So I think to some extent we do have to blame prosecutors when other people in the system don't provide the information, because they just have to start throwing hissy fits when it doesn't happen. I think the head of the office and the prosecutor themselves have to make it very clear that those people who do not provide this information in time should get disciplined, and that they will be very unhappy about it, and that they will seek sanctions against those who are slow or who hide the information or who don't provide it. They need to make it a priority and need to make it clear that to them it is just as important to provide exculpatory information as it is to provide inculpatory information. So I think sort of laying it on the dumb police, oh God, it's not my fault, it's their fault, I think is a little facile. And I think that ultimately the guy who puts the evidence before the court ultimately has to have responsibility for all the people below him who provide the information. Some sense of responsibility. And if he wants to say, oh, it was somebody else's fault, he has to show that he tried very hard to get it and it was willfully withheld from him.
I agree with Rory and would say only a couple of things. It was my experience in the U.S. Attorney's Office that you develop a sense for what agents are careful and cut all the corners square, and for maybe other agents who are not as careful, who don't take the time. And with that sense, you develop an intuition for who you have to ask a second or a third time. I suspect it works that way in other offices. The other thing I would say is that, again, while I agree with Rory, trying to look at it from the defendant's point of view, you can understand why it doesn't make any difference to him, what the particular source of is of the non-production of constitutionally required material. So I understand it from the defendant's point of view. I think Rory is hitting the nail on the head in saying that when defense lawyers fail to differentiate, they're not doing the right thing, because defense lawyers also develop a sense as to who, working with the prosecutor, when he says it, that's the case. You can take that to the bank, and who you need to examine a little more carefully.
I'm not sure if my microphone is still on, but I also thought I'd point out that the ABA is currently revising its criminal justice standards on discovery and very seriously considering open file discovery. So if you have comments on that, the Department of Justice now has a discovery coordinator named Andrew Goldsmith, and we'd love to get those comments.
In my view, again, the better policy, the better practice, simply because the prosecutor should maintain his reputation as someone who thinks it's not a game. His purpose is to bring out the truth. And that's how I always thought it was an easy job, because that's, you just go to your office in the morning and, that's the one thing you need to do. So open file discovery was a no-brainer to me. I would have reservations. I don't think that private organizations like the ABA, they can recommend whatever they want, but they have no authority and should have no authority to actually impose that. Nor, in my opinion, should the courts. But it should be imposed as a matter of executive branch policy.
I agree with that. That's what you need is leadership in the office, in each prosecutorial office, and that applies not just to the federal government, but to the states and the counties. Leadership and leadership that will emphasize the importance of protecting the rights of defendants. The sad truth is, in many places, that is not the case. In many places, the leadership sends the message that the only thing that counts is winning. Very bad way to run a prosecutorial office.
Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, my name is Drew Willie. I'm a criminal defense attorney, actually, and I wanted to real quick, before my question, comment on the about the resistance from the defense bar for taking away plea bargains. I was lucky enough to be trained by Gideon's Promise, which trains public defenders very much against that, taking for those defense attorneys that are doing it for the right reasons and not just for the paycheck, I think there would be encouragement for that to take more trials rather than plea bargains. They see the faults in it. And my question is about, in regards to open file policy, how do y'all feel about allowing criminal defendants to take depositions of state witnesses?
The defendant himself, as opposed to the defense counsel?
I think the question is about the defense counsel, the defense. I'm not saying anything about it because I have I want to hear what Professor Otis has to say. I've never heard of depositions in criminal cases, and maybe we should. But I was wondering what Professor Otis had to say about it.
I'm less something of a loss at the question. From one of the reasons is that my own, I handle the appellate end of things, which is the back end of cases, not the front end, where one would do depositions. It seems to me that the government bears the burden of proof. What exactly would the deposition be about? I'm not getting that.
I think that the deposition would be to question the witness about the proposed testimony. The witness, let's say, is perhaps a witness to a robbery. I think the idea would be that the defense counsel would question the witness about perception, recollection, ability.
I guess my view of that, and again, I should preface this by saying that I have no firsthand experience with the kind of the front end of litigation, is that the Constitution already provides a mechanism to question witnesses in a criminal case, which is different from civil litigation. And that is at a trial. I know, having had experience in the federal government, many of the federal cases, certainly the ones that I was connected to, involve drug gangs. That's what they are. And I would no more allow a defendant to depose a prospective government witness then I would fly to the moon, because what that deposition might ostensibly be merely questioning what it often is in gang cases is intimidation, and that I would not allow.
But of course, there are a lot of cases that where that is not an issue. Not every case is a gang case, and not every case involves that to the witness. The basic question is, absent questions of intimidation and threat and the like, why shouldn't a defendant in a criminal case be able to get an advance look at what the witness was actually testifying? A lot of the times, the police will list witnesses, and the witness will simply refuse to talk to the defendant. The defendant has no idea what exactly the witness will say or what at all the witness will say. It's just a pure guess, which strikes me as being a bit like trial by ambush. Is there any legitimate reason to say not to have, as in civil cases, a preview of what the witness is going to say, a preview under oath, and if there are problems with the witness testimony that might require providing other witnesses or providing evidence that the witness is lying or mistaken, give the defense a time before trial to gather the evidence?
Well, there are a couple of responses to that. One is that the defense is already entitled to a bill of particulars. Now, that is not witness testimony, but it does outline the government's theory of the case and what the government is planning to present. And my second answer would be, I would be more sympathetic to the caller's concerns if it were not so much my experience that defendants are not even interested in one opportunity to question witness, the one that the Constitution gives them at trial, and were so eager instead to end the case. I understand often on terms that are favorable to the defendant and favorable terms that he would not get by going to trial, but until defendants show more eagerness to exercise the one opportunity the Constitution plainly gives them, I don't know that I would have a great interest in giving them a second opportunity the Constitution never mentions.
Well, but that's not entirely fair. The being able to question a witness at trial when you have no idea what he might say, you know, has huge risks involved. So this is the trial is not supposed to be a situation where the defendant finds out what the witness knows because it's done right in front of the jury. Why not have the witness have the defendant know exactly what the witness is going to say, and be able to question him at trial or not question him at trial with full knowledge, rather than have to take a risk that the witness will say all sorts of things that are going to be damaging and unhelpful to the defense.
Well, as I said, I favor an open file discovery policy, and what the defense is going to find in that open file is they're often going to find agents' notes about interviews with witnesses. They're going to have a good idea of what the government's case is. Indeed, the principal reason that we have so many plea bargains, other than the economics of the system, is that the defendant knows from having gotten the discovery from the prosecutor what the strength of the government's case is. And the defendant correctly believes that by accepting responsibility, or at least getting what is under the guidelines a sentencing break for acceptance of responsibility, which often turns out, not always, but very often turns out to mean concluding a plea bargain, that is his best option. When you have open file, as I think is majority practice among federal offices these days, the defendant is going to have a very good idea of what the prosecutor's case is.
Let's go to our next question.
Hello, I'm a recent criminal defendant, and so I'd like to thank you for this thought-provoking and much-needed discussion. I have a number of questions, but today I'll just ask one, and my question pertains to pretrial publicity. Pretrial publicity has the ability to meaningfully bias the jury pool. Criminal defendants are pragmatically incapable of speaking to the press about their case, whereas prosecutors often use the media as a bully pulpit. Should prosecutors be allowed to go on the Today Show to publicize their cases? Where can we draw the line and how? Thank you.
I'll be happy to take that. The answer is no, they should not be on the Today Show. Prosecutors should present their case in court. That is their mission under the law. There was one recent case in particular that I was just astounded by. It's this Freddie Gray case in Baltimore, and the very young state's attorney, who I understand had just recently won election, came out after she had lodged charges and held a courthouse step news conference that she ended up by saying, and I believe this is a direct quotation, "Our time has come." And I was wondering who the "our" is. Who is she speaking for? It seemed to me to just be completely improper and revealing of an attitude that's all wrong about the professional obligations of a prosecutor. You do not go out on the courthouse steps and say, "Our time has come." You shut your mouth. You're perfectly at liberty to tell the press and the public about publicly filed indictments, for example, what the allegations of the indictment are. That's a public document. I have no problem with that. But holding a press conference, and a politicized press conference, just struck me as completely the wrong way. And it did strike me, as the caller intimates, as prejudicial and unprofessional.
Hear, hear. I see Thoreau, this is an old-fashioned prosecutor. And I applaud that. I mean, I think some of what we've seen falling, everything from perp walks, you know, carefully timed to terrible, and you know, they call the press there and see him getting bagged off in handcuffs and I mean, for one thing, aside from any other consideration, it just shows too much personal stake in the outcome of the litigation. Prosecutors should be interested in justice and should be interested in sort of the solemn but sad duty of punishing another human being. Should be something.
Yes, I agree with that. I think that's an excellent point, actually, that the prosecutor, although he is, you know, he is a litigant in a case and a party to a case, has to show a degree of objectivity that other litigants don't have to show, and a degree of objectivity that was utterly subverted by this Freddie Gray case courthouse festival. And it got worse than that. I live in Washington, D.C., so we're nearby Baltimore. I get a lot of the news. Apparently, the same prosecutor went to a rock concert given by the artist formerly known as Prince to show, I guess, sympathy for or some kind of alliance with Freddie Gray's family. Now, Freddie Gray did die in police custody, and I'm not saying the charges are unwarranted, although I have no idea what their resolution would be since I haven't seen the evidence. But for a prosecutor to follow up with a courthouse steps politicized news conference and then go to a rock concert as well, I was just flabbergasted.
Thank you.
We are over our time, but we have one more question that I'll go through really quickly.
Hi, this is Chris Green from the University of Mississippi Law School. I'm curious what...
Old Miss.
Yes, yes, at Princeton this fall. But I'm curious what you might reactions you might have to some of Bill Stuntz's proposals in his Collapse of American Criminal Justice. So he was a strong proponent of a duty to protect and supply the enforcement of the laws, but he also relied on Tom Tyler's work on why people obey the law, and he suggested that prosecutors should be required to show that they are systematically enforcing the law, and argued that really that would be a way to better protect and increase the legitimacy of the criminal justice system if they were required to adhere to, you know, kind of basic administrative law norms of the sort you see in Overton Park or the like.
Without knowing a lot about it, I once debated Bill Stuntz about Miranda, but other than that, did not know him. I know him by reputation, as most people do, as a very thoughtful person. Just given the description that you went through, I would not require prosecutors to state some systematic adherence to the law, and not because they shouldn't adhere to the law, but because there will be absolutely no settled definition of what systematic means.
Well, I agree with that, and I particularly agree with that insofar as any kind of suggestion that courts or judges impose such a duty. I think that would be a serious transgression on separation of powers. Now, if, as a political matter, a head of prosecutorial office, an attorney general, or a DA or the like, wanted to have such a policy imposes as a political or administrative matter because he believes that this is a builds public confidence, or because he believes that this gives him a better control on what his subordinates are doing, that would be up to him, and I might or might not applaud it depending on how it's worked out. But it would I would view it simply as a management tool rather than something that should in some sense be required by the Constitution.
Thank you all. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Professor Otis and Judge Kaczynski for joining us today. And thank you to our audience for your engaging questions. We welcome your feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Please join us for our next Teleforum on Monday, November 30th at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.